Hello, I'm Eddie Merckx. Welcome to the VeloCast.
And welcome once again to another edition of the VeloCast. My name is Scott.
And I'm a cold-ridden John.
You certainly sound it.
Yeah, I've got my Walrus of Love voice back. I feel fine, so let's get a podcast done.
Well, I'm glad you kind of got your traditional cold out the way before I have to spend a considerable amount of time with you on a plane and in a car as we head to Eurobike.
Oh no, I'm saving the really infectious stuff for next week.
Oh great, thank you for that. That's much appreciated. Thank you indeed. Now, coming up on this week's show, more riders playing team musical chairs, the Route de France, the Leadville 100, and weirdly, Mark Twain. But first, Team Sky's Edvald Boasenhagen powered to an impressive victory in the Dutch Food Valley Classic in Veenendaal on Friday, outsprinting last year's winner, Kenny van Hummel from Skil Shimano, with Stefan van Dijk coming in third.
A race with a name as hard to say as it is dull.
It does. I don't know why.
But Dutch Food Valley Classic. I mean, yeah. Really, who thought of that?
It's sponsorship where sponsorship shouldn't be allowed, really. I think there must be some kind of level of criteria that a company needs to meet before they're even allowed to sponsor anything.
Yeah. It's a good ride from Boasenhagen. It's his fifth win of the year and 15th win for Sky. So I think, they can say their first year's been a success. Although, no, you know, the grand hype that it was made out to be at the start.
Well, there's the issue there. As now past the tour, heading into the Vuelta, we can start to assess how a season has kind of gone for all the teams. And you've hit the nail on the head there. It's not quite been the one that they either hoped for or indeed talked up.
It's their own fault, you know, with their colour-coded stripy toothpaste and their pillows with stripes in them and all that kind of stuff. You know, they made the hype, they raised the expectations, although the press, and to a certain extent, you know, podcasters who aren't real press like us, did talk up their chances.
You talked about the launch and stuff, and I remember a lot of people saying they'd never seen anything like it in terms of a cycling team launch, and this was something new, this was something different. So I was trying to kind of, you know, which came first? It was a cart before the horse thing, maybe, that it's probably more Team Sky's fault for indulging in such things that the press, of course, get worked up into a frenzy. And I think they've shot themselves in the foot a wee bit.
Yeah, I mean, fair point, but if we step back from that, 15 wins in a season, it's a pretty good first season. And they'll build on that, because some of the young British riders who they're committed to bringing on are going to shock the Continental boys. You know, there's some great riders coming through. And I think with 15 wins, they've shown they're not a flash in the pan. The tour was a disaster for them because of Wiggins, but, you know, I said at the time, there's loads of people who've been fourth in the tour, and, you know, we've never seen them again that high, because the gulf from fourth or fifth to the podium is huge. You know, it's a chasm. So I think Wiggins, we've seen the last of him as a Grand Tour contender, but there are young guys coming on to take that torch. And they've got the backroom team, they've got the coaching expertise, we've seen they've got the media hype, you know, to keep the money rolling in. So it's a good first year. We'll see them building it, I think.
Well, I think I said a couple of weeks ago that I would have preferred Dave Brailsford to keep his chequebook in his pocket as far as Wiggins was concerned, and see how he did himself still with Garmin, seeing out the rest of his contract, and then make a decision from there on. Because if Team Sky had gone into this year saying, look, we're going to focus on the early races in the season, or we're going to focus on the one-day races, or maybe some of the classics, the tour wouldn't have looked that bad for them, because you had Geraint Thomas actually rode a storming race.
Stormer, aye.
And I think, I mean, as you say, what's this, Boasenhagen's fifth win of the year?
Yeah, I mean, they've been successful. It's just the big event they failed. So
yeah.
Now, I'm being very, very generous for me, actually. I'm usually far harsher than them.
It must be that cold. Now, Lizzie Armistead from Great Britain, who had finished top five throughout this week's La Route de France, capped off her week by winning the mass sprint in the final 118-kilometre stage.
and best young rider competition for the entire Route de France. Brilliant ride from Armistead. She deserves huge plaudits. I mean, this is the kind of step up that might open the floodgate of wins, you know, that we saw with Emma Pooley, for example. Once you get the first biggie under your belt, you know you can do it, so they, you know, they keep coming. This sounds like a brilliant race. We had a race so close in the final day that Judith Arndt, the veteran, at one point was in the leader's jersey on the road ahead of Annemiek van Vleuten, but she punctured and she fought really hard to get back on, but just couldn't manage it. And Armistead was really clever in the finale and won it. So another example of what we've been talking about all year. Women's racing has stepped up a grade. It's exciting racing that deserves to be watched. Whether, you know, you don't think about it as a second class event now, it's just good racing.
Yeah, and Arndt only was 6 seconds down on the GC, and as you say, it was a great race. My only kind of criticism, and this isn't of the race at all, but it's of the coverage. I really think we need better coverage of women's cycling. It was hellish trying to keep up with this race, which, as you say, was great, exciting racing. And as I say, it was a real struggle trying to find information on what was happening day by day.
No, it's a disgrace. I mean, we're getting decent coverage of things like Premier Calendar events in Britain, watched, as I've said, by, you know, one man and his dog and a few cycling club enthusiasts. We should be getting coverage of international women's cycling and Eurosport. We just should. And it's kind of a disgrace that we don't. The only reliable way I've found to follow is through womenscycling.net, where, you know, they're clearly keen amateurs and they're doing their best to keep folk up to speed with the racing. But the coverage is just a disgrace.
Yeah, but it shouldn't fall to, you know, this segregation thing again, you know, that all the major, you know, Eurosport Cycling News, so on and so forth, are there to cover cycling, but by default that's they're covering men's cycling, and we know that that's because it's more popular, but there should be more focus and there should be more coverage, and it shouldn't be left to these kind of segregated little ghettos of womenscycling.net to cover what is exciting racing. Racing should just be racing.
Exactly that. Racing's just racing. It should be covered.
Yes, now, Heimar Zu Beldia of Radio Shack snatched the overall victory in the Tour de l'Ain by just 0.2 of a second from Walter Poels of Vacansoleil, who won the final stage in Belley, France.
Now, the Tour de l'Ain is fairly typical of loads of races just now in the gap between the Tour and the Vuelta. There's racing going on everywhere, and you know, we couldn't cover it all. The important thing for me in this, or the interesting thing, was that Zu Beldia he hasn't won a race for 10 years, which I can't believe for a rider of his class.
No, when and I now, read that, I thought, is that right? Surely that can't be right.
No, I went and checked, and it is right. You know, classy rider. I remember him being back in Euskaltel, and he always was a strong time trialist, good rider in the mountains. So the fact he hasn't had a win for 10 years gobsmacked me. But he won the prologue on this, and then after a gutsy ride in the final stage, took the overall. So congratulations to him.
Yeah, and as we kind of alluded to, he matched Puel's time, and the entire race had to be decided on the prologue result.
Yeah, they didn't need to bother having the rest of it. It would have been
fine. No, they could probably just have decided it there and then. Rounding that off was David Moncoutier of Cofidis, who was second on the stage and subsequently third overall. Now, other than this being the 10-year anniversary of Zu Beldia's last victory, there was an interesting incident on stage 3 of this race. Did you see that?
No, what happened? I missed that.
It was BMC Racing Team's Steve Morabito, who was stripped of his victory on stage 3, gifting it to Maxime Bouet of AG2R, because the race officials deemed that he had failed to properly follow the course during the final 2 kilometres by going the wrong way round a roundabout.
That seems a bit harsh.
It certainly does.
One of the classic overhead shots is riders going round both sides of a roundabout. Was it much shorter one way or another? I mean, if it wasn't a closed road, that seemed brutal.
Well, he said after the race, I attacked to the left side, got a good gap and stayed away to the finish. So, I mean, you could read into that the distance round the course was less going that way round. But he also went on to say, after the race, they told me I was supposed to go to the right around the roundabout, but the road was not closed to the left, and even the motorbikes were going round that way. I was feeling good today, but not now.
I would have been appealing that if I'd been his DS, I think. That sounds harsh.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there is any any advantage to be gained round one side of a roundabout, i.e. just the way that the roundabout sits on the course, that it means it's shorter to go one way, and you don't want the riders going that way, then close off that section of the road.
And if it's open, it's just sensible and canny racing to take the shorter route.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Now, moving on, Tyler Farrar from Garmin Transitions showed that he's back to his best following the Tour de France fractures that he had to suffer by taking a repeat victory at the Vattenval Cy Classics race in Hamburg.
Always a good race to watch this, and a delight for the sprinters. Must be a real booster for Farrar to win this, though, and against decent competition. I mean, Eddie Bosenhagen after the Dutch Food Valley whatever thingy, Andre Greipel, Alan Davis, Benatti, you know, they were all up there and were shown a clean pair of heels by Farrar. So it must be a nice way to get back from the disappointment of the Tour.
Yeah, do you know what struck me about this? I thought the Vattenfall Cy Classics race was a whole lot older than the 15 years that it actually is.
So did I. I mean, there are people who think the Amstel Gold's still a young whippersnapper. But yeah, 15 years, it's hardly been here any time at all. And for a while, actually, it looked like it might go away after the German doping scandals. So, you know, it used to be the HEWC Classic. So it's good to see it still here with the same sponsor. They just changed their name. And it's a nice showcase for the sprinters between the Grand Tours, and it keeps our interest up.
Now, Dan Martin, also of Garmin Transitions, has won the 90th edition of the Three Valleys of the Varese race.
Yeah, I mean, brilliant ride. He attacked Pozzovivo, Colnago CSF, with the lovely frame with the battery mount, not saying anything, in the last kilometre of the final climb. And after winning the Tour of Poland recently, he's clearly hanging on to a rich vein of form. I'd forgotten he was actually the nephew of Stephen Roach.
Do you know, it was one of those things when I read it, I thought, he is not, is he? And then I remembered that I had read that before and probably had exactly the same reaction. But there you go.
Just shooting. Genetics will out. I mean, that's Pozzovivo's chamois in the picture of the winner's podium is possibly the most disturbing I've seen all year. I mean, people just shouldn't wear chamois like that.
There's Martin, an award waiting to happen. For the most
I hope it's his chamois. But I mean, Martin's a great run of form. Tactical nous is showing he's a clever rider, you know, in all situations. And I think next year we'll see great things from him, which probably means somebody will poach him off Garmin. But great race, good win. And this is another one of those, what I was talking about earlier, those wee races in the background where you've got to cover them all, because there's still big riders on, or you've still got to look at them even if you don't talk about them. Because we had the likes of Canego in here, and they're not second string races. You know, Martin won against serious in-depth competition and deserves applause.
Yeah, they're also, you know, they're showcases for different types of riders in that, as we've said before, that hole between the Tour de France and the Vuelta, with people maybe even preparing form for the Worlds that are coming up.
Yeah, I mean, they're interesting racing. So, I mean, I've been looking at loads of them and we can't talk about them all, but there are a couple that needed picked out.
Yes, another that needs picked out, but this time it was because of Sten De Volder, who made history this week by winning the Belgian time trial title after having already taken the road title back in June. Now, this makes him the first rider ever to do so in the same year.
Which is awesome when you think about the number of Belgians who've been riding. You know, because Boonen can turn in a decent time trial. So, I mean, this is a genuinely historic achievement. And I hate to use it, but chapeau Stein. I mean, great rides.
Yes, he said, this is a dream come true. After having claimed the National Road Championship title, I really only focused on this race. I wanted this historic double result. I competed at the Tour of Poland while actually thinking about today's competition, and during the past week I trained really hard with my time trial bike in order to leave nothing to chance.
And next year he'll get to wear both jerseys. You know, in the Tour de France he'll get to keep the same jersey on all the time, whether time trial or the normal race. Yeah. So just a brilliant ride. Brilliant.
Yeah, and
ride.
I think he's going to have a good time in the forthcoming in Echo Tour, as the race apparently goes quite close to his hometown. So expect to see his smile probably from, you know, the other side of Europe.
Yeah, well, that's going on as we speak, and we'll cover it next week. It looks like a good race. Classic roads in the, you know, the lowlands. So he's going to be happy taking those jerseys through that country.
Yes. Now, well, we discussed the rumour last week that Riccardo Rico, the controversial Italian who tested positive for Serra EPO during the 2008 Tour de France, was to sign a deal to join Quickstep. Now, according to a story in La Gazzetta dello Sport, Rico had signed a deal with the Belgian outfit through the end of the 2011 season. However, the plot was soon to be as thick as his blood when, soon after it was announced, he was signing with Vacan Soleil instead.
I actually find it hard to talk about Rico. You know, he gives gingers a bad name. It's just, he's a horrible little man. And Vacan Soleil, I've seen a couple of tweets from people who are now worried about Vacan Soleil, largely because Rico's going there. I'll find it really hard to cheer for them as I was cheering for them this year with a, you know, with a wee bugger there.
Well, there's a couple of interesting things here. First of all, it was him himself, it was Rico that told La Gazzetta dello Sport that he had completed the agreement with Quickstep. So
yep,
that's bang out of order for a start. If you haven't actually, you know, if the ink's not dry on the paper, you shouldn't be going to, you know, talking to the sporting press on stuff that hasn't actually been agreed. And
yeah, but he's never shown he's in control of his mouth.
No, that's very, very true. A good point well made. And I think,
did you see,
I
mean, what his manager said?
No, go on.
Or not his manager, rather. Did you see what the manager of Vacan Soleil said?
Yeah, sorry, I was going to come to that in a sec. Before we get to that, what I was going to say was, maybe reading between the lines, if the negotiations with Quickstep hadn't been finalised and he was blabbing his mouth off to La Gazzetta dello Sport, maybe that irked Quickstep and caused the deal to fall through.
Or maybe they realised what a little turd he was and decided not to sign him.
It could have been that. Who knows? Now, you alluded to it there. Director Sportif at Vacan Soleil, Hilaire van der Schuren, told...
Great name.
Yes, quite. Told Belgia, which I think is a newspaper in, funnily enough, Belgium, on Wednesday, "We have finally reached an agreement. It is a contract for two seasons. We did not take risks in recruiting Rico. I personally feel that everyone is entitled to second chances. Actually, he was not our first choice. Initially, we wanted Scarponi, but when the negotiations did not work, we looked for the services of Sanchez. But that didn't work out either. I kept looking and finally came up with Rico. I immediately had his blood values checked with a renowned Dutch laboratory, but there was nothing suspicious to be found." So, you know, if he's not feeling a bit kind of hard done by, he should do, you know. Actually, we really didn't want them, but, you know, we couldn't find anybody else.
No, I mean, it says it all, really. He's also talked to the organisers of the Grand Tours, and they all said, yeah, he can come back because he's served his sentence. And we've said that all year, you know. If you've done your time under the current rules, you need to come back. And I'll be perfectly clear, I'm dissing Rico, not because he's a doper, you know, he's done his time, but because he's an objectionable little man. And I like the fact that, in public, the DS isn't going, "Oh, he's the greatest rider we could have got, I'm really happy," which is what they tend to do when they're talking up a sign. And he's going, "Actually, we looked at everybody and went, you know, when we found the scrapings at the bottom of the barrel, there was Riccardo."
And we needed someone to ride a bike, and anybody would have done. Apparently, subject to the UCI registering him in time, he will make his debut at the GP Pluie.
Can he wait?
Well, I mean, as you say, it's not the doping thing that's really an issue here. As you've said, we've always said, you serve your time, you should be allowed to come back. But the thing,
he's a wanker.
He's an objectionable little sod. I don't really think bad of Vacan Soleil. And as you said, the director has been fairly categoric in saying, you know, he was third choice at best for the team. But come back to the rolling billboard argument from last week. What does having this misogynistic moron representing your brand say to people?
Have a nice holiday. I don't know. We'll sell you a package to get away from him.
Yes,
who knows?
Possibly. Now, it was announced on Monday that Carlos Sastre will leave the Cervelo test team for Geox next season.
Apparently, he wasn't offered a contract for Cervelo, which must have felt like a bit of a kick in the nuts for him.
It really surprised me because, I mean, even the move itself, before I read further on to say that, you know, it's been suggested that he wasn't offered a reissue of his contract, I was surprised because I actually saw Sastre ending his career at Cervelo and then working kind of behind the scenes to develop new talent or work with the, you know, the bikes, no, so, so did on and so forth.
I mean, he was in with the foundations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was essentially the centrepiece of the new team when they formed. And everybody was surprised that he'd left Reese to go there. So to see him, you know, dropped and having to look for a new team at the age of 35, I was a bit disappointed, because what he showed this year, and we talked about it time and again, is heart, you know? Just a rider with heart, and a rider who, when he'd been dropped, didn't sit up, he just put his head down and went for it, and got some decent results. So that Gaelic's team, it's going to be a strong team next year. And I'm sure Sastre will ride his heart out for them.
Well, I was going to ask what you see his role being, because surely he's not going to be pitching himself in Grand Tour terms, is he?
Well, maybe we should look at one of their other signings before we talk about that, because I think what you've got is a kind of a 1-2 punch going on, because they've also signed Menchov, haven't they, for next year?
Well, I mean, you can hardly keep up with the transfer musical chairs at the moment, and so was the case with Denis Menchov, who up until today was rumoured to be signing with Katusha. However, the third place Tour de France man will also be riding for Geox next season with the aforementioned Carlos Sastre.
Yeah, and that's my point. You're in, not the Tour de France, but you're in, say, the Giro or the Vuelta, and you've got Menchov, who's really up for the Vuelta this year. You know, he's talking himself up big time for the upcoming race. But you've got Menchov and you've got Sastre. Even at 35 for Sastre, 36 next year, you can't let either of them go up the road. So you've got a strong 1-2 punch. And I think it's a sensible choice. And Sastre's got a lot to pass on to younger riders in terms of intelligence, so he'll be a good team captain as well.
Well, that's what I was kind of alluding to earlier on there, was I don't think he's Grand Tour material anymore, but is he there as the experienced old hand? Because the other names that are floating around in terms of the rumour mill going to Geox are Damiano Canego, and I've also heard talk of Yanis Brakovic and Chris Horner. Rumoured to be in talks with the team as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a well-rounded team. I hope they change the strip, though.
Oh, that has
really
to have. Yeah, that really has to have, and that should be priority number one, is change the team kit for next year, please.
Well, the thing is, the riders they're talking about, I mean, it's a team I can support. You know, it's a team that I'll enjoy watching. So I kind of watch a team in an ugly kit, so get on with it, please, and redesign it into something attractive.
Well, Damiano just simply won't wear it. I don't imagine him going anywhere near it with a barge pole, so I think for that reason and that reason alone, it'll have to be redesigned.
Fingers crossed.
Sticking with transfer news, Czech rider Roman Kreuziger will leave Liquigas, the team with which he began his professional career, to head to the Astana team of Alexander Vinokourov.
Yeah, I mean, he's 24 years old. I think he's got a Grand Tour in his legs at some point in the future. I could see him as a Giro winner quite easily. So I think he's a great signing for Astana.
I totally agree with that. He himself has said, Vinokourov makes a great impression on me.
I'm sure he does.
Yes, with a big club, probably. He has a
Make
feel
you an
for
offer
what...
you can't refuse.
He has a feel for what is important for the team. Vino is a wonderful man, always a great competitor. I'm glad that I can work with him in the same team. His words have great weight in Astana, followed by the solution of many issues. You can just picture, as I'm reading this, I can see Kreuziger speaking into a microphone with a gun in his temple saying, read this.
Aye, or Vino's hands firmly around his testicles, squeezing harder. To be honest, Vino, I've kind of warmed him a wee bit after being openly hating him earlier in the year.
I think openly hating is actually somewhat of an understatement, John, let's be fair.
I wasn't too keen on him at the start of the year. But, you know, he's come back, he's done his time, and he's ridden brave races this year, and we've seen him working hard. And next year, he's going to be a force on the road for Astana, and following that, as Kreuziger says, it's pretty certain he's going to be their manager. So I think Kreuziger's looking for the long game and looking for a team where he can, you know, he can win that Grand Tour that I think he's got in his legs.
Interesting for me. I mean, I understand, you know, he's seen a team there where next year he will essentially inherit the leader's jersey. I wonder why he fell. I mean, was it simply a money issue? That he's been at Liquigas for 5 years, and as we said there, he started his professional career with them. Do you think that there was any issue of him getting leader's status at Liquigas?
Oh God, aye, because you've got the likes of Nibali and Pellizzotti, not to mention, you know, Ivan Basso. So I think it was a fish, or he was a small fish in a big pond at Likigas. And at Astana, I think he's going to have far more freedom. So yeah, I think it's a good move for him.
Okay, now after predicting their imminent demise on last week's show, only a day later it was announced that the Castapagna team had secured its future thanks to communications giant Telefonica.
I think I actually said they're screwed.
Oh, yes, I think that was a quote. I mean, I can dig out the MP3 and we can play
no,
it back
fine,
if you like.
Fine. No, you
sure,
don't need to do
sure?
that.
Because
no, it's fine.
It's no trouble. It's no trouble.
Although, to be fair, I then said, which means they'll get a big sponsor in the next week.
And I saw you, I think about 4 hours later when you said you'd never believe what's just been posted.
Aye. Telefonica, huge company. Yeah, I mean, just a huge company. So this has secured the future of the team for quite a while. Conspiracy theorists might like to note that Telefonica were a huge supporter of Alonso in his early years in Formula One. So this is the Alonso and Bert super team for the future being built up. Mark my words.
Do you think? Because, I mean...
No, I don't really. I'm just trying to make something interesting to podcast about.
I was reading this thinking that the sponsors must be absolutely kicking themselves for not getting this deal sorted out quicker, because I think Bert would have gone to a Spanish team if the deal was right, and that would have given Telefonica maximum bang for their buck in their opening season there.
No, I think you're right. I think Bert would have jumped at this, but it wasn't in place in time. Unzu wanted to sign him. You know, he was gagging to sign Bert, but the money wasn't there and the future of the team wasn't certain. So, you know, for Alberto, he's made a sensible choice with the help of Specialized moving to Saxo Bank. But this was tailor-made for him, and it all came together too late, I think.
Mm. What's with the name? Team Movie Star? It sounds like the name of a dodgy Betamax video recorder from the 1980s.
It's one of their sub-brands. That's all.
That's all.
They use it in F1 as well. I mean, it's a name they use quite often in promotion. So I'm used to seeing it on cars, so I'm not that surprised, but I can see how it might look a bit weird.
It certainly did leap out for me. Now, Stefan Schumacher, the German rider who tested positive for using EPO during the 2008 Tour de France, hopes to return to racing this season with Italian outfit Misch.
Another one that I'm happy to see back.
Yes, I thought you might.
Not. I really didn't like Schumacher either. But he's done his time. He deserves to come back. What I like is, essentially, he had a chat with Pat McQuaid, who assured him he was welcome to return to the sport and that the UCI will not put any obstacles in the way of his comeback.
Biting,
I hate to bang the drum again. They've got nothing to say about it. They've got nothing to say about it. It's nothing to do with him. He's done his time. He can come back. Anyway, I've finished ranting about that.
Well, I'm biting my tongue here, and so much so I think I might start to bleed soon. I mean, he still not said that he did anything wrong. I seem to recall a couple of years ago he was threatening to sue. Now, was it either the UCI or was it the EFLD for defamation of character back in 2008?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really crappy year for Gerolsteiner, wasn't it? Because they had Bernard Cole as well. So
which goes back to that story we discussed last week about the former manager.
About Leipheimer, Holzer and Leipheimer. You know, no guilt by association, just saying. But he's done his time. He deserves to come back, and we'll see how he performs. You know, we'll see how he performs. But I'm not going to go out my way to support him.
Well, I'm sure we've all heard of mobile bicycle services, so much so that I seem to recall Monty Python making a sketch about it. But now comes the Blacktop Mobile Cycle Shop, which is a bike shop without the shop bit.
Which, I love this idea. You know, from a business point of view, your overheads are cut because all you need is a storage locker and it's nowhere to put your kit, and you ride to your customer. As you say, we've seen loads of mechanics who do this, and it's a great idea. You know, you're at your work, somebody uses a cargo bike, we'll talk about one later in the gear section, rides along with their full mechanics kit, services your bike at work, you've got no inconvenience. The great thing about this is they'll also come and sell you a bike, you know, be it a custom build. They'll convert bikes from fixed gear they'll do conversions from geared bikes to fixed gear. They're a full kind of boutique bike shop who turn up and talk to you face to face. And that's a great idea.
It makes sense as you talk, but I think in about 30 seconds' time, my brain will just reset and it won't make any sense at all. I take it what we're talking about here is someone coming to your house or your place of work. So you would essentially put on an appointment and they would show up and say, right, what is it you need? Take your measurements, that kind of thing. What kind of bike are you after? Show you maybe some catalogues or whatever, or go online, et cetera, to show you, well, you should be looking at this kind of bike or what's your, you know, budget, so on and so forth, and give you a kind of advisory service from there on in.
Exactly that. I mean, they're adding value because they're giving you face-to-face time. And, you know, they're not pressured by customers waiting to be served because, you know, you've got a slot of their time. So they can spend the time they need, get to know you as a person, size you up properly, talk about what you want, and then through, you know, they've got a really wide variety of places to source parts, they can build exactly the bike you need. And looking at their gallery, they've done some fantastic custom builds. So from a business point of view, as I say, I love it because the overheads are minimal, and, you know, there's no risk in terms of stock because you're custom ordering all the time. But from a personal point of view, they're adding value to the transaction because they're actually one-to-one with no distractions, spending time with you to make sure you get the bike you want. So I've never talked to them, you know. They may be rubbish, although looking at the gallery, they look like brilliant folk. They're, you know, they get great reviews from people. It's just a nice idea.
And I suppose that's one of the biggest problems that the internet has is that face-to-face thing where any of us could be sitting looking at a bike or any product online, and in the back of your head is always that, actually, is this right for me? Because I remember, just as you're talking there, I was thinking about, you know, I was talking about Merck's bikes, and you would say, you know, I would have a Merck's bike in a heartbeat, Scott, because I would just love to have the guy's name on the top tube, but I know the geometry won't suit me.
Yeah.
Now, you would really need to know your stuff in order to know that, and I don't think a lot of people do.
No, they don't. I mean, we know they don't. And that's what used to really annoy me in the shop. Not so much in the wee shop in Peebles, but in, you know, big shops like the Edinburgh Bike Co-op. People would often come in and use your expertise to determine what they needed and then go online and buy it at a cheaper price, you know, because online, just like this place, it has the benefit that it doesn't have the overheads of actually providing a physical shop. But, yeah, it's taken away the guesswork. It's given a real expert in your face the time to assess what you need and talk about what you want, so it's adding value to the transaction. Good stuff.
Yes, and you can find out more at blacktopcyclery.com. Now, we've spoken highly over the months of our admiration for the government-backed bike to work scheme that runs here in the UK. However, according to the Guardian newspaper, the scheme could be at risk because of a clarification in the rules from the tax office.
Essentially, they looked at, was it Rolls-Royce?
Yes.
Because the common misconception with this bike-to-work thing is as soon as you start paying for it, it's your bike. But it isn't. You're actually hiring it effectively or leasing it from your employer. And yet after the 12 months, you're supposed to buy it at a fair value or something, a fair second-hand value.
Yeah, and I think it's the fair second-hand value that was kind of an issue here, because I think a lot of people were led to believe that the full market value would be 5% of the original price tag, which after a year sounds incredibly generous to me.
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, I want to be angry about this, but I can see where they're coming from.
No, totally.
You know, 5% after a year, I'd be disappointed with that rate of depreciation. And I think they're talking about, is it 25% now?
Yeah.
Which, it still seems fair to me. I mean, I'd expect to get more than 25% of its initial value for a second-hand bike. But what it does do is it takes away a lot of the incentive, which, you know, to be frank, was putting bums in seats. Posties at my local office, you know, where I work, who never ever would have thought about cycling to work, go bike to work scheme bikes through the Royal Mail and use them every day. I'm not sure they would have done that if they'd been told, actually, you're going to have to cough up 150 quid after a year. So, although I agree with the numbers, I think it could be, the start of the nails in the coffin lid for the scheme.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. It's incentivising people, and I think, as hard as it is to say in such difficult times, the government needs to be looking at a bigger picture here in terms of health benefits, congestion on the road, so on and so forth, in making the hurdle that people need to get over to get on a bike as small as it possibly can. And as you say, although you agree with the numbers in terms of what the bike should be worth at the end of the year, I mean, the guy in The Guardian that was writing here expected to only owe his employer, The Guardian newspaper, £35 by the end of the scheme. It turns out he's going to have to pay, I think, what was it, 175 quid,
which, yeah, which is 140 quid more than he expected.
And another article I saw on this, written by Carlton Reid at BikeBiz, was saying that he'd been in touch with a shop selling high-quality Dutch bikes that's calculated that a typical customer of his would now make a grand saving of £19. And you kind of think, well, why would I bother just for £19? I think there's a huge amount of incentive there because you think you're getting something at way below the market value, which makes it easier for you to put up with the wind and the rain and all the other perceived barriers to that people have for cycling to work.
No, absolutely. And I mean, Carlton makes a good point by saying that the way to do it isn't to up the final buying price, but to make sure the bikes bought are suitable for commuting and are actually being used for commuting. But yeah, I think taking away the incentive could see the beginning of the end for this, which I'm sad about because it's a scheme that's put a lot of bums on saddles.
It has indeed. Now, just a quick mention of an article on the Cyclicious website detailing how, on a visit to Portland in 1895, Samuel Clemens, more commonly known as Mark Twain, suggested the city should invest in a publicly owned bike sharing operation, which he envisaged as a money-making operation for the city.
There's not much to say about this. I just think it's genius that as we look at rollouts like, you know, the Barclays scheme in London, the Vélib' in Paris, we've talked about millions of the things, it seems like. A century before that, Mark Twain says, be a really good idea for this city to own some bikes that it hires out to its populace. I love Twain. I mean, I've read him since I was a wee boy. And a man of real vision that just deserved a mention.
Yeah, as I say, just a quick mention, and I couldn't agree more, to use my catchphrase. Now, I think we were all a bit surprised to hear that Minnesota had been named as Bicycling Magazine's best biking city, taking over from usual suspect Portland. And an article that was sent to us by one of our listeners in the Minnesota Business website says that the city is now reaping the benefits of being number one.
The interesting thing for me is the chap who sent us this, what he was actually talking about was there's a real feeling of excitement and a feeling of momentum in Minnesota, and he's seeing more and more bikes and the infrastructure's being built up really fast. So I think, you know, reading this article, looking at the financial benefits it's bringing in, we're seeing a real change for the better here, and this could be a kind of an example for other cities thinking of jumping in with both feet.
I mean, I took from it as well that, you know, as I said at the start of this, we were all a bit surprised that it was Minnesota that was named as America's best biking city, because you immediately think of places like Portland. Yeah. And also that Minnesota, I think it gets snow, you know, for three quarters of the year as well. And you think, well, how has a biking culture evolved there? But of course, that's just it, that you can use the bike every day.
Yeah, and I mean, there are companies like Head Wheels, you know, who build some of the best wheels in the business. Banjo Brothers, which is a really cool wee company that makes bags and accessories. Twin Six, Clothing Folk, Bike Racks, Daro Bike Racks. I mean, the whole city, which I'd never even thought about as a cycling centre, now has a culture and is following through on that culture that makes it a buzz to be there if you're a cyclist. So they deserved another mention after us saying they'd got the first one when we saw that. But there's real money happening as well, so it's a good example.
Yeah, they reckon that it's bringing $315 million a year to the city's economy, although Joe Mahan, who's economic analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota and himself a year-round bike commuter, says it's tricky to measure the specific contribution that biking for transportation, recreation and fitness make to the fuzzy notion, as he puts it, of quality of life in the Twin Cities. But these amenities probably play a role in attracting talented and educated people in the same way that a good school system does, and that has real effect on economic growth, even if that can't be measured.
Yeah, it's a UN plot.
That's what it is. It's a year-end flop. Now, it looks like the Tour de France is fast becoming nothing more than a warm-up race for the Leadville 100, where Levi Leipheimer from Team Radio Shack showed off the fitness he acquired at the Grand Boucle this year to complete the tough mountain bike course in 6 hours, 16 minutes and 37 seconds, bettering the course record set by his teammate Lance Armstrong 12 months earlier by 12 minutes.
I think the advantage that Leipheimer had was he was being pushed. You know, Armstrong's last year, and I'm not biting the fanboy towel here, so back off, folks. But Armstrong's last year was
Doesn't he get touchy?
Well, anyway. As I was saying, Armstrong's last year was essentially a long time trial. You know, he was on his own for most of the race, whereas Leipheimer was being pushed. It doesn't sound like it, because Horgan Kubelski, who was second riding for Subaru Trek, was 8 minutes back. But I think Levi always heard, you know, that breathing just behind him, where he was being pushed. Dave Wiens continues his great palmarès in this race. He managed to finish fourth, only 17 minutes back. Todd Wells for Specialised was third. I followed this race online and saw some great pictures. I mean, I want to get out there and watch this. It looks like a brilliant event.
It certainly does. And Levi himself said, "That was ridiculous. I don't know if I've ever suffered as much as that before. GHK was super strong and I was worried because I was suffering on Columbine. I'm just not that used to the altitude and he was hanging tough. But I guess that the distance and the fitness from the tour was enough." Although he added, "Although we didn't go this hard in the tour." Yes, I think we've probably spotted that, Levi. But anyway,
I tell you, the other thing that got me is Todd Wells crashed and trashed his front wheel. And he was handed a wheel from Ned Overend, his teammate. Now, Ned Overend must be 120 or something. When I was a young boy looking at mountain bikes, Ned Overend was a champion and he's still up there. That's longevity, and that deserves some mention as well.
Yes, now Boardman Bikes, owned of course by former yellow jersey wearer and all-round cycling god Chris Boardman, are looking to expand the business with plans for international distribution in 2011.
I don't think any brand's left me as conflicted in the last year as Boardman has, because their bikes, you look at the spec, they're fantastic value, they're well designed, because, you know, Boardman's actually involved from the ground up in the design, well specced, as I say, and they're sold through Halfords. Which is patchy. To be fair, some Halfords are very good, but some of them are rubbish.
Yeah, to explain, Halfords is an odd combination of bike shop, car accessories shop, doing everything from alloy wheels to CD players, you know, in-car entertainment, to camping equipment, and goodness, have I forgotten anything?
They've been a bad word for, or a byword for bad bicycle mechanicking for as long as I've been in the bike trade. And in fact, I've often sent co-workers to Halfords to buy a cheapish bike and then said, "And bring it to me and I'll set it up for you." You know, because the old thing, I'd rather ride a £150 bike well set up than a £2,000 bike, you know, built by a
badly
monkey.
Badly, yeah, quite.
It's really hard to buy a bad bike now. So a lot of the Halford stuff is perfectly serviceable. And the Boardman stuff's brilliant. And in some of the shops, you get people with a real passion for cycling and you'll get great service. But some of them, you know, you get a monkey who would, as you say, fit a CD player as quickly as trying through a wheel. But this brand, all year, I haven't seen a Boardman bike I didn't like. And the fact it's looking at going international, we can see it in some shops that aren't Halfords. So, you know, you won't have to wear a badge of shame when folk go, "Oh, you bought that bike at Halfords."
Which is
snobby,
I know, but it's
ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I mean, I think it happened. We were buying some camping equipment, I think, and I saw them for the first time and I thought, that is a lovely looking bike. And then I saw them when I went to the Nocturne in Edinburgh last year, I think, probably for the first time, kind of out in anger. There was a few leaned up against the team bus there, and when you actually see them in the road, they are beautiful looking bikes. But as you say, there is that, it's just snobbery, it's bike snobbery, and you go, "Well, everybody's going to know that I bought my bike at Halfords." But they are stunning looking bikes.
No, they're brilliant bikes, and I mean, I'd have one in a heartbeat.
Mm. And I've seen this to you before we started recording, I'm actually genuinely excited to see the 2011 range that they'll be bringing out at Eurobike when we go to see them.
Yeah, it's Chris Boardman's one of my favourite riders. He always has been. You know, he's extremely analytical, pays extreme attention to detail. And the fact that the bike brand which he's launched with his name in it hasn't tarnished that legacy, you know, it's enhanced it, if anything, is something that makes me very happy. And to see them going global, I'm glad to see it.
Now, the 7th annual edition of the North American Handmade Bicycle Show, scheduled for Austin, Texas, 25th to 27th of February next year, is shaping up as potentially the biggest year yet, in part because of the popular Austin location, but also because of a large surge of activity within the handmade bicycles industry.
Now, at a time when we're still being told we're at risk of a double dip recession, when money's tight, this niche of the market, which we've talked about since the very first show, I think in the very first Velocast we talked about the North American Handbuilt Bicycle Show, is going from strength to strength. And these small manufacturers, who we talked about, you know, around Minnesota, that they have the confidence to pre-book a show like this in a climate which is admittedly difficult, it gives you a good feeling about the future of the industry. So I wish we had the money to go there. I'd love to go and see this.
Yeah, I mean, there was an interesting interview in this article with Lon Kennedy of Nova Cycle Supplies, and he says there's a lot of factors involved in this. And he says one of them is the increased awareness and status that NABS has given to all frame builders. He goes on to talk about the growing awareness of US hand-built frames, which obviously involve extreme high quality and precision manufacturing. And the third factor is the growth in good websites that serve as shop windows for the builders themselves. You know, a lot of people are now confident to buy direct from them.
Yeah, it's that added value thing. You know, it's not a faceless corporation. You go to a show like this, so you buy from someone like, you know, Sasha White at Vanilla or Richard Sachs or whatever. If you've got, you know, the 25 years of your life that is the waiting list for getting a frame or whatever it is just now, you feel you're dealing with a real person. You feel part of a relationship. It all adds value to the transaction, and you end up with a product. However much we like. Yeah, and we love bikes from the big manufacturers. There is something really special about having something where you know the person who's built it. And guitars as well. You know, it's just something that human nature craves, a relationship, and small companies like this provide one.
Yeah, I mean, they do talk about the fact that some companies have disappeared over the years, but there have been, you know, the encouraging thing is that there have been new ones have come in to fill the gaps there. I mean, you would start to worry if companies were going under and nobody else was popping up to fill, as I say, the gap in the market that has been left. I thought it's interesting as well that the NABS show itself moves from city to city each year. Whereas, you know, the bigger shows like, you know, Eurobike, which obviously we're going to, is always in Friedrichshafen. Interbike is always in Las Vegas. It's interesting.
Well, that's scale, isn't it?
Yeah, I
mean, you know, Eurobike. Can you imagine Eurobike saying, right, we want to move this year. Where else can we find something the size of a small city to put bikes in? And, you know, Interbike to a certain extent is the same thing. They're victims of their own success, whereas NABS is still small enough that any decent convention centre will be able to put them up. And the product they're showing is brilliant. I'm getting all wishy-washy here about it, but as I say, we've talked about this since show one.
Yeah, I mean, I think they say themselves that there was one year where they stayed in the same city 2 years in a row, and they felt that the show itself was flat on that second year, and continued to think, no, we need to keep moving it. So as I say, I thought it was an interesting idea to move the show round about America year in, year out. Now, on to the fantastically monikered Woody bicycles, which, as you imagine, make bikes from wood.
We've seen some really beautiful bikes made of wood. You know, where we talked about the Purple Heartwood bikes, which where you choose the wood to suit the colour, and they look very much like specialised rebays. We've talked about bamboo bikes. These are fugly. I mean, they're just... I'm sure they're very nice people, but they're amongst the ugliest bikes I've ever seen in my life.
Okay, to kind of explain here, you've got what is, it looks like one piece of wood, although it won't be, but it's like a wooden slab as the chain stays, and then you've got another wooden slab as the seat tube, and then another wooden slab as the top tube, and that's it.
And think Fred Flintstone.
Yes. Mounted on top, you've got a kind of Brooks-esque saddle and kind of cruiser-type handlebars. Yeah, I see what you mean. I mean, I'm always one to try and kind of see things as being beautiful from a design point of view, but I'm sorry, these are fairly ugly. I've got to agree.
It looks like it looks like Chris Boardman's Lotus made in a high school wood shop. That's what it looks like.
It does, actually, yes.
And I mean, as I say, lovely people, and they're quite unique. I mean, they're almost pieces of sculpture the way they look. But there's no way you'd get $2,500 out of me for one of these. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, it's $2,500. The prices seem to be around, and they do a kind of, what do they call it, the 007 cruiser, which I think is just under $3,000. So if you want to have a look, you can find out more at woodybicycles.com. Now, as my gran used to say, the nights are fair drawing in, which for those of a non-Scottish persuasion means it's getting dark earlier and earlier each night. So it's with that in mind that we turn our attention to the new Mukluk snowbike from Salsa.
I love this. It's kind of like a Surly Pugsley, but slightly less extreme, and only slightly. In essence, if you've seen a Pugsley, you know what we're talking about here. We're talking about extravagantly oversized tyres that you can run at low pressure, and a bike that still handles well. So you've got a rigid fork, rigid rear end, no suspension at all, disc brakes. The whole thing about this, though, is you could run these tyres at 10 or 15 PSI, effectively have a full suspension bike and gain traction on surfaces you wouldn't believe a bike would ride down. And what Salsa do well, suddenly I've always thought I've got this reputation for utilitarian stuff, you know, where form definitely follows function. And they may not be the most beautiful bikes, but you know thought's going into every aspect of them. Salsa are pretty similar, but they've always had just that wee frisson of style to them, you know, they're a bit more exciting than the Surly stuff. And this is just nice. It just looks like an ordinary rigid mountain bike where somebody's put the wheels on steroids. I like it.
Well, I knew your love of the Pugsley, so yeah, I wasn't surprised to see you bookmark this. One question, though. Mukluk. I mean, what kind of name is that? It sounds like it's Klingon for woman of easy virtue.
No, it sounds Eskimo to me. I've no idea what it means. We'll have to find out.
Sure. You can find out more information on that, as they've got detailed spec, etc., although no details on pricing yet, at salsacycles.com/bikes/Mukluk, which is with a K. Now, we've talked about the Bullock bike before on the show, but for reasons best known to himself, my esteemed colleague here would like to draw your attention once more to the Mad as a Bag of Cats cargo bike that is the Bullet.
I don't think we talked about these the last time, because I think we were in a phase where we'd had so many cargo bikes, we were a bit cargo biked out.
No, I remember specifically talking about the Bullet bike, because I'd never seen anything like it before, and it was a very, very early edition of the show. So I've got no problem, you know, talking about it again, because we had probably about four listeners the last time we spoke about it. But
we're up to six now.
We're up to woo!
This was the reason I wanted to talk about it again, actually, is Sean Lally of Cycle Systems Academy, who we should get as a full-time sponsor, as well as giving us a great prize. We seem to mention him every week. But what he's said is he's got one of these to try, because they do the mobile mechanic thing. You know, they do the thing where somebody goes to their workplace and services bikes all day, and that's a service they provide. And he's really excited about getting this bike. So essentially, it's a range of bikes where all the frames are the same. And it's kind of like it's a low-loader front, where the cargo's in front of you, a small wheel that's steered by a rod, and you sit on a reasonably normal-looking rear end. But you can carry everything up to a small car on these things. And the models are differentiated largely by their components. You know, it's a mixture of SRAM or Shimano Alpine, hydraulic brakes, Brooks saddles, puncture-protected Conti tyres. Just go and have a look at the site. I mean, it shows you what can be achieved with a bit of imagination. This could replace a small car for a lot of people in a small town.
Yeah, I mean, my only concern over such things, and it only comes from a kind of experience, is the handling on them.
Are we remembering Velorbis here?
We are remembering Velorbis. And much as I loved that bike, the Mobi that I tested out, the handling was interesting, to say the least, especially when going round corners. And it may not be the case with the Bullet, because I think the centre of gravity seems to be a whole lot lower down. You kind of felt that you're very high up on the Mobi. But that would be my only concern about being so long and trying to get round a corner with any degree of certainty.
I think it'd be just like adapting to a tandem, because the big difference with things like the, you know, the bullets is you're on two wheels, so you're still in the same kind of physics of riding a normal bike. You know, you lean to turn and that sort of thing. A lot of the confusion, I think, with the Mobi is it's a trike, and I've talked about how weird they feel to ride. So I think it'd be no more difficult to adapt to than being the captain on a tandem. And as I say, it's a solution where I could easily see myself doing a full week shopping without having to, you know, go near a car.
I mean, they are massive. Having seen them in the tin, as it were, they are huge things.
Huge.
Yes.
I might actually ask Sean. They're away on their holidays just now. I mean, Julia. I might ask Sean to do us a mini review of them once they've had a bit of time with them, and we can talk about handling and that sort of thing, and it'll give us a good insight, I think.
Yes. Now, in the meantime, you can find out more at Larry versus Harry, which is LarryVsHarry.com. I think it's probably time for some picks of the week.
Do you want to go first?
Okay then, my pick of the week. And according to the website, the Social Bicycle System, or SOBI, is a public bike share system that uses GPS, mobile communications and a secure lock that can attach to almost any bicycle and lock to any regular bike.
It looks very cool. I mean, I'd never heard of this. So what I think like about it...
I think it's very recent thing, and I think they've been getting a lot of press on a lot of tech websites because of the technology that's being used, and I think they're seeking funding via some Pepsi-sponsored kind of innovation fund that's up at the minute.
Yeah, the Pepsi Refresh Project.
That's
but,
the one.
But what I like about this is, I mean, we've seen endless numbers of these things, and in fact we talked earlier this week about Mark Twain, you know, foreseeing it. Where I see this really working isn't in a kind of urban environment where a city provides it or, you know, that sort of thing. I could really see this working, and they talk about it as well, on enclosed universities, you know, like Angus's at Stirling, yeah, or in corporate campuses. I mean, I can see the Googleplex having loads of these kicking about with an Android app.
Yeah.
So it's a lot cheaper. I mean, you were saying when we were talking before that for something like the Barclays, they worked $4,000 a bike, and they think they can come in under $1,000 a bike for this. So... It's an interesting addition. It might just work. Worry is, it only works for folk with smartphones, doesn't it?
No, apparently you can also you can just use a text message to request the location of a bike, and I think there's a kind of callback system that they're talking about using as well. So I think they're obviously trying to address concerns over it only being an iPhone or an Android app type environment, and that there are kind of more traditional old school ways of finding out where these things are.
That's sweet. It looks good.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of quite encouraged to see that the founder of this company, Ryan Rezpecki, I hope I pronounced that right, has a BS in marketing from Penn State and a master's in urban planning from Hunter College, and he previously worked at the New York Department of Transportation in their bike program. So it's somebody that is coming from a bike background rather than from a tech background and think they can just step in with technology, will solve everything kind of attitude.
Aye, so there's some grounding in reality as opposed to I've written the app so we can make it happen. No?
Yeah, exactly.
Watch with interest.
Yeah, and you can find out more about that at socialbicycles.com.
My pick of the week's better than yours.
You say this week in, week out, but go on.
Well, no, I feel a bit like we've become a kind of friends of the Velocast pick of the week moment here for me, because a couple of times I've picked stuff from people we've met, and this time I really didn't mean to.
I'm putting this down to just sheer laziness. That's all it is. It's nothing to do with kind of Velocast nepotism or anything. It's just sheer laziness that you can't be bothered going and looking for a decent pick of the week, so you just choose the first thing to hand.
I actually had a really good pick of the week this week. So good that I'm not telling you what it is and I'm saving it for next week.
Okay.
But yesterday, I got a parcel in the post from Alex Cahill at New Radio Comics. And he'd kindly provided 10 prints of a print called The Cyclist, signed limited edition prints for the first 10 winners in the Velocast Fantasy Tour, which we did in association with Simon Lam at La Gazzetta della Bici. And the prints arrived, and absolutely stunning. I mean, beautifully printed on really good quality stock. And he kindly included a couple for you and I, and there's one for Simon as well. So I'm picking something I've got for nothing.
Right. But before we go any further, I would like to just point out to all the people who
it's PO1,
have,
isn't it? It's PO1.
All the people who have kindly donated stuff to us, and I'm going to include Jeff at Velo Reviews, who has donated a lot
nice
of stuff.
Hat.
We've got a hat, which is lovely. Thank you very much, Jeff. You know, we're going to talk about this print in a second here. And you keep saying there's one for me and there's one for you. And also go back to the clean bottle. I haven't seen a damn thing yet.
No, well, it's because we never talk to each other now. We do it all by Skype.
You're hoarding it. That's what it is. I've not got my clean bottle or anything.
Well, no, I do feel like a bit of a whore talking about this. But I like it so much. And I mean, you know me, so you'll know what this means. That this morning I went into McHardy's Framing, our local expert framer in Peebles, and I'm paying 50 quid to have it framed. That's how much I like this. So even though I got it for nothing, 50 quid is leaving the Galloway pocket. Buy one of these prints. They're gorgeous. They're really high quality. $10 inside the USA, $15 outside. I spent 50 quid getting it framed.
Well, I'm absolutely shocked that a hand went to your pocket and actual money came out as a result of this. But I mean,
well, you've
from
seen
what
the number
said,
of IKEA frames in my house. You know, I mean, if I got a Van Gogh, I'd probably frame it in something from IKEA. But this I liked so much that I actually spent proper money to get it framed properly.
No,
it's
and,
a lovely
fairness,
wee bit
when,
of art.
When it arrived, you did phone and you said you should see these. They're absolutely gorgeous looking. So I look forward to actually seeing it in the print, as it were. And I think on that bombshell, that £50 bombshell, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you so much for listening and staying subscribed. You can contact us at our website, velocast.co.uk, or on Twitter, where we are at Velocast. Well, I hope you all have a great week and hope to speak to you all again soon for another edition of the Velocast.